AT&T Technology and Operations. Thank you for joining us again.
Thanks, Mike, for having me.
Great. Well, I think just jumping right into your priorities.
Before we jump in.
Yes, please.
Can I just put the safe harbor statement up? I spent all night studying it. It's the least we could do. No, to the extent of making forward-looking statements, the safe harbor is available on the website. But in addition to the safe harbor statement, which I have to talk about, we also, ground rules-wise, we've got an S-4 related to the merger available on the website as well. And just a reminder that we're in the quiet period for the spectrum auction. Can you operate within those guidelines?
I think there's some questions left in the deck here.
Yeah, I had a feeling you might.
So starting off, each year at the beginning of the year, I think it's always a great opportunity to look forward into the coming year. And if you could share with us your strategic and operating priorities for 2017, and maybe even how they changed from a year ago.
Yeah. Well, I think that if you look at the big themes of our investment, M&A excluded for a minute, our priorities remain the same. The first strategic and capital priority is to ensure the networks that we have are operating at the right capacity and with the right quality. You have to sustain the franchise you have, and that always gets a very high priority. I think one of the things that has changed rather significantly over the last few years is the amount of investment that we have in software development, and both in the numbers of projects and in the things that we're doing. If you look at software-defined networking, last year we made the decision we were going to push into open source an 8.5-million-line project, which is an operating system for the network. And networks have been built with many flavors and versions of operating system, and we're very excited about that. You look at DirecTV Now, you look at the evolution in the enterprise space to network on demand, NetBond, the security offerings. A lot of things that we're doing now are software projects that really transform what the customer buys from us, how they buy it from us in a digital fashion, and then the underlying network itself. So, Mike, I think everything is really moving in a pretty dramatic way right now on both the customer end and then how we deliver that.
So in terms of focus, what are the most disruptive opportunities that you're working on to bend the cost curve for the network and help you compete in the marketplace?
Well, there's a couple that come to mind. If you look this morning, we talked just about the 5G evolution, and that's disruptive in a number of ways. If you look at the evolution of the wireless network from 2G to 3G to 4G, most of that, the economics of that case were predicated on efficiency in spectrum. So avoiding buying more spectrum, putting more bits across the hertz that you had. And 5G is different because its performance is so much better that it's going to enable a whole bunch of new-to-the-world use cases, whether it's live maps, autonomous cars, virtual reality. So the performance of that network is going to be a potential game changer. And then I mentioned earlier just software-defined networking. Software-defined networking is just a radically different way to deliver the business that we deliver today, both in the form of new services the customer sees, but also just the delivery of the bits with the handsets and the premise equipment the customers have today. We're doing it fundamentally differently, and we're well into that conversion curve now. And I think that's going to really bend the cost curve in a very big way.
So working backwards to some of those comments, if you look at SDN and your efforts to virtualize the network,
Yeah.
How are you doing on your progress to get there? And can you help expand for everybody what the cost savings are? So when you go to SDN and virtualization, is it labor? Is it real estate?
Is it electricity? Like, how do we conceptualize what the actual efficiencies are that you're driving towards?
That's a great question. And the definition of a great question is one I know the answer to, and it's points I wanted to make anyhow. So as you look at software-defined networking, what it allows us to do is manage our network in a very different way. So if you, the simplest thing I talk about is, the way I describe it is in failover. Our industry grew up that if you wanted really high reliability and you had a card on a shelf, you had to have a redundant card and a redundant shelf. And then you had to have a redundant route. And all of that stuff was done with physical hardware. You had to rack it, stack it, deploy it. And much like the web scale players do today, where software moves around, that's the way our network will work in the future. And so we're not going to buy appliances. So the analogy I'll draw for you is it's much like an app store. And so when we deploy in our network a node, we drop software on there, and so we're not buying an appliance to do firewall. We're not buying an appliance to do routing. It's a software load. We drop the software load on, and so we can move that around very fungibly, and that allows us to go from 2 times n to get reliability to n plus 1 or n plus 2. And so the amount of utilization you can get in the network goes up dramatically, and that saves in every way, shape, or form. So the case itself, there are several things that you save on. First of all, you save on hardware. Mm-hmm. Secondly, you save on software cost because you're not buying redundant functions anymore. Historically, when you bought an appliance, you bought it with what was there, whether you used it or not. I'll use an analogy. It's sort of like, you know, if you have a mobile phone that has a flashlight, you carry a flashlight, you paid for the flashlight on the phone, you might as well use it and not buy the flashlight or carry an alarm clock. That's sort of the way it works in networking. You buy a function once, and you call it and use it. So that flash on your phone that used to be a camera flash is now a flashlight, and I saw a company that's doing blood analysis with it. You know, it's available for all to use. That's the way networking works. And we used to buy things over and over again when we bought them in square boxes. And so you save on hardware, software, you save on space, you save on power, and you save considerably on manpower that it takes to operate the network.
And in terms of your progress in an aggregate sense, you've had some virtualization goals.
Yeah.
How's that shaping up? And where are you today?
My team is thrilled by the fact that I take all of our important metrics and I announce them to the whole world in kind of the February timeframe. I put all of our targets out in the public domain, and then I'm accountable in January to sum it up. So this will be the first place I talk about it. Our target was 75% of our network, our wide area network functions virtualized by 2020. Our target for last year was to be at 30%. So we hit 34%, which we're really thrilled with, because the hardest part of any, you know, if you think about how big scale projects go, you have a year of planning, you have a year at 5%, you have a year at 30%, then you have a year that takes it kind of to the 50-60 range, and then you start to burn down the tail. The hardest part of that curve is not the planning. It's the most important. The hardest part is going 5 to 30, because that's where you have to get really good at scaling. So for us to hit 34% of our network functions now in software really bodes well for us for 17 to get the things done that we want to do.
And you mentioned 5G, and there was a press announcement about some of your announcement today on 5G. Can you help explain what you're accomplishing with 5G, what the service to the customer is going to look like, and in some respects, you know, does it evolve? Does it start at something like fixed wireless and then move into mobile over time? How should investors think about the evolution of this?
What we tried to do this morning was change the game a little bit, because I think whether it's analysts, investors, customers, that they and the industry itself has kind of taught everyone to think in terms of network evolution within a franchise. So wireless goes 2G, 3G, 4G, 5G, and then wireline goes fiber to the node and fiber to the curb. And what we try to do this morning is say what we're going to do is we're going to put these on platforms. Because it's not just the network technology, it's also the software that rides on top of it and what you're able to do, what developers can do, services they can get built. And every year we've been increasing the amount of dialogue we've had with partners, with developers, and with customers. And so what we did this morning is we said that the 5G evolution is about evolving all of our access technology. And we called that platform Indigo. And we've laid out with Indigo what we're going to do in wireless. Mm-hmm. So we talked this morning about 5G trials in wireless, going very well. Economics, propagation are not a surprise. The speed and latency performance we're getting, I think, is a very positive surprise for me. I'm going to say that personally. I think my team looks at theoretical kind of stuff. I look at economics, propagation, and network performance. I think network performance has been a positive surprise. And so we took the next step in 5G, and we said this morning we're going to, in addition to doing an enterprise trial for fixed wireless, we're going to do a DirecTV Now trial that will put the DirecTV Now with the broadband, and we'll do some friendly trials with that. So we'll look at both of those enterprise and consumer use cases, and then just sort of a check mark that says on 5G, everything is moving along. Our strategy all along has been to pull the whole globe and try to pull the standards up as fast and furious as we can. And I, you know, if you look right now, we've brought the time frames up at globally, not we as AT&T, for 5G, the standards for mobility up into the 2018 time frame. So we're very optimistic. To take a minute though and answer the specific question, 5G is a powerful network technology, and the nature of it is such that you can do it in two phases. All of the others, the standards were done at once. In this case, the fixed case will be done in phase one before the mobile case. And if you think about it, when you go to a home, I just need to make it work for the home. If I give you a handset and you're roaming around, I have to make it work with, you know, connecting with Verizon. I have to make someone who comes over here from Tokyo with another handset work on our network for roaming. So those added interfaces, complexity, handoffs, if you will, make that part of the work take a little longer.
Okay. And in your mind, for the fixed case, do you foresee a device sitting on a kitchen table near a window, or do you see this being more of a professionally installed outdoor, you know, kind of, you know, antenna in terms of how the fixed wireless business case will work itself through?
Well, in the announcement this morning, Mike, we talked about 5G, but we also talked about the evolution of 4G to go to a gig, getting a gig out of LTE. And you know that we've made some commitments to do wireless local loop with the LTE technology. We also did an update on where we are on air gig, which is putting a wireless signal not through a power line, but on a power line. And that's really a game changer economically and performance-wise. And the reason I bring that up is we as AT&T are uniquely incented as a result of merger conditions plus the breadth of our portfolio geographically and the spread technologically. We still have ADSL customers that are getting 1.5 meg. And so we're uniquely incented to try to get any technology we can advancing to this 1 gig at favorable economics. And so we're looking at G.fast, we're looking at fiber to the home, we're looking at air gig, we're looking at evolution of LTE, we're looking at 5G. So you see, we really don't think that there's going to be one ubiquitous access and overnight you're going to flip a switch. We want the premier economics for the best network performance, and we want to evolve our network as quickly as we can.
And just taking a step back, how important is the wireline network to the mobile network?
Well, you're one of the analysts I can talk philosophically to. So if I were to look at you and say, philosophically, how far does a bit travel over the air in the wireless network? I arrived at AT&T 9 years ago, and the average distance of a megabyte is cut in almost half. So that means you need a denser wired network. And if you look going forward at the millimeter wave spectrum, the higher spectrum ranges to carry all the cargo of video, those get to be smaller propagation footprints. That lends itself towards small cells. It's no surprise to anybody in this room that the velocity of small cells is going to increase, and that means you need more capillarity in your wired network. So fiber becomes more important. The density of that fiber becomes more important because right now the physics in the ground are better than the physics in the air. So we try to get it into the ground as fast as we can. So the ground-based network, having control over the economics and the performance of that, we view as a very central part of our strategy going forward.
Where does the mobile network stand today in terms of quality and performance and your ambitions to deploy that 40 megahertz of spectrum that you began talking about last year?
Yeah, so, you know, we're blessed with a really good portfolio, which allows you the optionality to either do incremental capacity for capacity's sake or to potentially provision for speed's sake. And we've kind of we try to keep our intervals to deploy world class, and we look at where competition is. And so, you know, we in the announcement this morning, we talked about the fact that, you know, we see a path to getting 1 gig on LTE under certain spectrum conditions using unlicensed in conjunction paired with licensed spectrum. So we're very optimistic right now that we have the optionality to be able to get the performance that we need. If you look right now, we're in the best shape we've ever been on dropped calls, network accessibility, those sorts of things. But increasingly, the network competition has been focused on more of the data-centric services than voice-centric.
So some of your competitors would say that they have more spectrum per customer, and therefore they can deliver much better performance, mobile broadband performance, over time. How do you react to that? Is that a fair observation, or do you have a different take on it?
I have a different take. And in networking, I think it's always challenging in generalizations. Sometimes in simplification, you don't just take liberties, you change facts. And so it's complex because the network loading is time of day dependent, how many spectrum ranges you have, the type of application. And so, you know, again, we feel like we not only have the spectrum going forward that we can farm into, but we're also continually optimizing and remining. So we've been very pleased with the network performance that we've gotten, not just from internally, but the independent bodies that measure such things.
Maybe changing gears, you launched DirecTV Now?
Yep.
Back in the fourth quarter. Can you talk about how that's been doing for the company? Any progress you could share with us in terms of subscriptions, in terms of performance?
Yeah,
of the
we have earnings in a couple of weeks where we'll lay out some of the customer metrics. So let me just stay on the network side of it. We're very pleased with how the network has performed. And when we look at it from a network standpoint, you're going to look and say, how many customers, how much are they going to use, and what's that mean from a network consumption standpoint, and you make sure that you keep out in front of the capacity needs of that. As I mentioned, the spectrum helps you quite a bit. And so we've been very pleased with how the network has performed. We've been not at all surprised on some of the consumption characteristics. So we'll have the customer metrics out and earnings in a few weeks, and I think that you'll be able to judge at that point whether how successful it is.
Are you seeing any impact in terms of video loading for your own customers that have both, and are these customers subject to the Stream Saver feature?
Well, the Stream Saver feature, what we're doing was different, is we're allowing people to turn it on and off. And so I know that a lot of folks think of it in terms of, you know, curtailing or throttling, but a lot of the devices don't have the capability, or the content itself doesn't have the capability that the network does. And so you don't want to over-provision a network resource that's more than used. And so what we did with StreamSaver is, you know, we want to handshake down into matching the network to the device, but we have given the customer the option, without charge, by the way, to be able to go to a full enablement of the full stream. So it's different in that regard. I think, though, when you look at the customer profile, you know, we sort of made a bet, if you will, that video, with video continuing to move, that if you took video in mobile and its trends, and you took video in the home and its trends, a lot of our strategy centered around the belief that a lot of that video viewing would move to handsets and mobile. And I think we're seeing that, not just the growth of DirecTV Now, but just the TV everywhere, the engagement, the number of streams. So we're starting to see really good growth rate in video consumption over mobile across all platforms.
And as you think about capital spending, and particularly for mobile, how do you think that that looks over time for the company?
I think that, you know, with 5G upcoming, you know, the timing has been such that, you know, we shut down our 2G network 4 days ago. So,
and how'd that go?
It went really well. You know, the nature of it is you inform customers, you put plans, you help them, you know, you narrow it, and then there's a few folks who, you know, run it into the ground and you're not quite sure. So what we did is we soft locked it before we completely decommissioned it in case there were life or death situations. But it's gone extremely well. We just really haven't had any customer escalation. So I think, you know, knock on leather, it went really well.
And what does that save you in terms of dollars? Is that a significant source of savings by shutting
it
down?
Well, the savings has been accruing over the last couple of years because we've been, with the traffic declining, we've been grooming out circuits. So green dollar circuits that we pay others for have been groomed out. The rents and leases, or you do an intercept where our growth in small cells and 4G has been there. So a lot of it has been mined out, but there is considerable opportunity for us as we go through the physical shutdown and decommissioning.
So as you talk about decommissioning a network, you've spoken in the past about your aspirations to bend the cost curve across mobile, including for tower rents. Where does that stand today for you? And, you know, how do you think about, you know, what you're looking to accomplish? Is it, you know, you're trying to get more equipment on without, you know, having to pay for it? Do you just want a lower aggregate cost? What are your aspirations on how you approach that side of the cost structure?
Yeah, the analogy I'll use is a real estate one. Today, the structure of the industry is such that every time I carry a television into the apartment, I have to pay more for the apartment. And so the two governors there are, we really ought to be paying by the driver of cost, which is square footage and structural integrity. And secondly, we have to align the cost to our revenue growth. And if those are out of alignment, then it's high on our radar screen. We have very, very few cost streams that that grow faster than the revenue that they support for very long. So it's a very high priority for us to get rents and leases category down significantly. And we've done a great job making a dent the last 2 years. But the dent has been in the growth rate, and we've not reached our objectives yet.
And how does that fit with the need to continue to densify the network? And, you know, in the one hand, it sounds like you have more to deploy as you go to 5G and you try to improve capacity for users. Yeah. So how do the two fit together?
Well, it makes it very difficult. But you know, those sorts of transitions, Mike, are the expertise of our company. As I remind you all the time when you look at looming threats, we were supposed to die from distance, and then wireless was killing wireline, then data was killing voice, and then, you know, text messaging was going to go away. So that's just a curve that we have to manage, and I think we're getting smarter about which assets can carry this. Traditionally, the whole concept of a tower started with a piece of turf and a hut and all those sorts of things. So we're really fundamentally rethinking the footprint that we need, where we can hang those structures, and we've been very creative as we look at small cells. And it's interesting, if you were to drive around, in some cases I would have to point out to you where the small cells are, because they show up. We have them that are integrated into bus stops. We have them in light poles that are part of the light fixture. And so there's some really creative designs there that make for a different real estate partner than we've traditionally used. And I think that provides us the more stealth our design, the more options we have for real estate, and the less imposed upon the real estate owner may feel with that infrastructure.
So as you're reconfiguring all of your networks, you know, wireline or evolving wireline, wireless, are there parts of the network that you no longer need that give way to potential divestitures, whether it's data centers, real estate of some kind, even for central offices? How should investors think about the opportunities for you to take things out and maybe use that as a source of monetization for the company?
Well, we've been using it as a source of cost reduction, you know, kind of within the space, if you will, for quite a while. And at some point, you reach a tipping point where the assets itself can be reconfigured. One of the things I'm most proud of, I have a small team that reruns our network designs every month. It takes 30 minutes. And then I have a team that goes out and grooms the hardware out of the network. And we've gotten really efficient at that. And those are the considerations. What can we shut off? Where can we take power out? Where can we shrink footprint? But with a balance sheet of our size, you can imagine that it's an ongoing process for us to look for asset opportunities of things that are either non-strategic or structurally that are just not necessary in the future.
How many people do you employ overseas? And under the right conditions, how many of those can come back to the U.S.?
Well, we don't provide a breakout on employees, but I'll just speak for myself in the technology and operations team, and I represent about 130,000 badged employees and about 90,000 non-payroll workers. You know, we have a group that regularly looks at everything from cyber landscape to economics, and we look at the globe as not only where we serve customers, but where we deliver from. And so we at least annually, but often semi-annually, we'll go back in and reevaluate that. So anytime you get into a favorable condition related to taxes or performance, we move the workforce around. So it's not a new endeavor for us, but anything, you know, like what we've seen here politically, that changes the calculus, we're going to take advantage of that on behalf of shareholders, behalf of customers.
And speaking of government, can you share with us where you are in the FirstNet process and how investors should think about what that does for AT&T over time?
Yeah, well, it's premature with the nature of the bid process for me to do more than delineate and highlight for you a couple of facts. The first is that, you know, we know there were three bidders, and one of them has declared that they've been non-competitive. The second got a notice of non-competitiveness and filed a legal protest to that, and we've been notified that we're in the range of competitive. And that's, at this point, that's all we know, and anything beyond that would be speculation.
We've got some mics roaming around, and so if you have questions, please raise your hand. We'll find you a mic. And while we get that process started, if we can go to our first survey question. So in front of you, you've got a little remote control. And so the first survey question is, do you believe 5G fixed wireless will be an effective competitor to fixed broadband services? And you could choose one, yes, two, maybe, or undecided, and three, no. And if you want to click those buttons, we'll tabulate the results. So 35% came in with yes, 32% maybe undecided, and 34% no. Any thoughts?
they're split vote there. Okay, well, here's the way we think about 5G fixed wireless. It's last night I was meeting late in the evening, and someone said to me, with DirecTV Now, a tablet, and a mobile phone, why do I need a mobile connection? And I said, because some people have two televisions and a family. And my point is that you're going to end up with certain people looking at different technologies and saying, that's plenty good for me. And so I think 5G wireless, the economics right now for fixed are unproven. And that's why we continue to push AirGig, which is, I think, a little bit more of new physics, if you will, that has more promising economics than 5G for fixed. 5G will work for fixed. It'll work in certain locations. But we're going to look at wireless local loop on LTE. We're going to look at 5G for fixed, and we're going to look at AirGig for fixed. And wherever we get superior economics is where we're going to go.
And do the marketing people ever come to you and say, can we call this 6G because 6 is more than 5?
No.
Do we have questions in the audience? Okay, let's go to this survey number 2. How many DirecTV Now customers will AT&T end 2017 with? So 1, less than 500,000. 2, 500,000 to 1 million. 3, 1 million to 2 million. And 4, more than 2 million. So feel free to make your selections. So it came back with 13% saying less than 500,000. I'm reading these for those on the webcast, by the way. 40%, 500,000 to a million, 34%, 1 million to 2 million, and 12% more than 2 million. Mm-hmm. Any thoughts?
No.
Okay. Let's move to the final one.
I can't believe you tried that. I would remind you, I do technology and operations. I don't do any pricing or customer forecasting.
So, speaking of technology, AT&T's standalone capital spending guidance for 2016 is in the range of $22 billion. What will AT&T's standalone capital spending be in 2017? So choice 1, increase more than 10%. 2, between flat and up 10%. 3, between flat and down 10%. Or 4, decline more than 10%. So polls are open.
This is kind of fun.
Okay, so the results are 17% came back with increase more than 10%, 60% between flat and up 10%, 23% between flat and down 10%, and 1% decline more than 10%.
Mm-hmm. This works like Heisman voting. You're going to know the winner at earnings in just a couple weeks.
Are there any other questions from the audience? And then
there's one there.
Morning. Any comments on developments in Mexico and Latin America for AT&T? I mean, in terms of CapEx, network, I mean, things that you can say from your area of expertise? Sorry.
I'm not sure I caught all the question, but it was related to Mexico.
Yeah, the question is with the network in Mexico?
Basically, comments on Mexico in general. I mean,
okay, sure.
There's AT&T making a lot of announcements on making a big investment and in not also network, but
right.
Many other things in Mexico and Latin America. So, anything you can say on that?
Right. Yeah, we've been very pleased with the progress we've made in Mexico. I think the it's a long-term investment for AT&T. There's a lot of ties between our customer base in the U.S. and the customer base in Mexico, whether that's consumers or families or whether that's enterprises. And so the investment thesis we had around favorable regulation and a market that was, if you will, the market itself, its characteristics looked a lot like the U.S. market a few years prior with the when it was really rapid growth of smartphones and all that sort of stuff. And so that thesis remains intact. If you look at what we've done in the build side, we went through a build where we took USASEL and Nextel, and we converged it into an AT&T network. We wanted to build high-quality distribution, high-quality network, and we wanted to transform how the employees serve customers. And we thought that that would be favorably responded to, and the customer metrics in Mexico would bear that out. And so I think we're very pleased with the market and the performance we've had in the market. We've been on or ahead of schedule in our committed build levels there for coverage, our network quality there in most of the major areas where we've started independent drive processes. We have the highest quality network. And so, the only downside has been the currency and the exchange rate. Those are going to go up and down. Our commitment to the market is for the long term. So we've been very pleased. As a matter of fact, we just recently opened one of our concept superstores down there for retail. And the market's reacting extremely well to it.
So last question. You, I think, announced this morning an update on the fiber to the home deployments.
Yeah.
Maybe just review that with us. And what's the delay to when you actually pass the home and you announce you have a certain number of homes passed with fiber versus when it's open from a marketing perspective and when you can actually start selling broadband and other services into those homes?
Yeah. So this morning we announced our number for 16, nearly 4 million homes passed. And the cadence is that when we pass a home and register it, we're using the same database to report those numbers to the FCC for the merger commitment that we use for marketing and selling. So if there is a lag for some reason, it may just be the timing of when we hit the market with promotional items. From a network perspective, its readiness is coterminous with the registration and the announcement of it. So those homes have been and are available, and in most cases we're selling into them.
Great. Well, John, I want to thank you for joining us today.
Mike, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.